Welcome to the Matthew Moran Podcast. Hello, and thank you for your patience. As you probably know by now, I'm all about quality and not quantity on this podcast. It's been a while, but it's been an unbelievable year for me, one of the busiest and most fun, combining creative work, which is well paid. It's kind of like the holy grail in our industry. So I truly feel grateful, as I know these moments are few and far between, but you've got to make hay while the sun shines. I've been filming Foxes all year, spanning across two projects, and I'm probably being a bit disingenuous when I say I'm done with Foxes, and I'm also just going to give up saying it now too, because I was so lucky. In January, I was asked to film for the forthcoming David Attenborough show, which is called Wild London, and I'm delighted to say it's going to be aired on New Year's Day on BBC One at 6:30 p.m. I haven't seen it myself. I'll be sitting back and watching it with everyone else for the first time, and I have to say it was a total and utter joy to work on. And wow, doesn't get much better than meeting and filming with one of your heroes, a hero to so many. And yeah, well, it was just a delight. I don't even really know what more I can say about it, other than that, you know, if I could financially retire, I probably would, because working with David Attenborough, well, it doesn't really get much better than that. But having said all that, the podcast remains important to me and you, the listener. And, you know, I always release one around Christmas time. In fact, the very first podcast I released back in 2016, we're on Boxing Day, and this week's Boxing Day special guest is Kev Morgans. Kev is an absolutely brilliant wildlife photographer, storyteller, and conservationist, and he's probably best known for his work with Atlantic puffins. This is a subject he's dedicated an extraordinary amount of time with, but he also shoots much of his work in the UK and focuses primarily on documenting seabirds. And I've known Kev for a while, but got to meet him for the first time. I was super excited about this, and I got to see him speak in October at the European Wildlife Photographer of the Year Festival in Germany. And I was delighted that he agreed to come on the podcast for a chat. So look, let's not waste any time. Let's get into the conversation. Here's Kev. Kev, thanks so much for coming on the podcast, taking the time right at the very end of the year. How are you feeling?
Oh, it's great to be here. Great to finally get on the podcast. Super excited, especially in the Christmas build-up too. Always a good time.
Yeah, you're going to be the Christmas special.
The Christmas present.
Christmas present to everyone. Yeah, exactly. Now, this is awesome. It's so cool. I finally got to meet you at the GDT Festival in Germany. It's the European Wildlife Photographer of the Year. You know, we had contact probably over the last 10 years of, you know, liking each other's pictures and, you know, encouraging each other. And, you know, I've followed you for such a long time and really love your work. So it's, first of all, it's so great to meet you in October and so great to have you on. So thanks again.
Oh, no worries. Likewise. It was so great to meet you too. As you say, you kind of, it's a weird world, wildlife photography. You can know someone for over 10 years and not actually ever meet them before. So yeah, it was good to finally meet in person.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And I was thinking, it's, you know, always, we can come back to sort of how you got into photography. We'll get into that. But the first question I was going to ask is, you know, at the end of a year, like, do you do that kind of reflecting on, you know, 2025, the hits, the misses? You know, can you sum up this year for you as a wildlife photographer?
Yeah, it's been another incredibly busy year, really. Yeah, I had some amazing kind of, well, accolades, really, like you say. Speaking at GDT in October, that was a real highlight for me. It was pretty special to be given that opportunity to speak there. And again, just my usual puffin trips, starting in March, May, June, July. Constantly my mountain hare workshops. The Falk just got back from the Falklands too, which is pretty incredible.
Oh, amazing. And that is,
the Falklands is, it's an amazing place.
That's brilliant. And so in all of these places, are you running trips as well as doing your own shooting? Is that how it works?
Exactly, yeah. So I always make sure to factor in time for myself. It's just, yeah, you need to, as a wildlife photographer, we can't just be constantly leading trips all the time. You always need to factor in time for your own photography too.
Yeah, and that's brilliant. And I think that's one of the hard things. Like, I've spoken to Andy Parkinson, know he's a good friend of yours. I'm sure he'll pop up in conversation
Yeah, I'm
throughout the
sure you
next
will.
hour. But yeah, Andy Parkinson's been on the podcast before, obviously great British wildlife photographer. And, I've talked a lot with him about that, running trips. And it's just, to try and do any serious photography when you're looking after guests, just forget it. So do you always make a point of just setting aside time for yourself either before or after a trip, or how does that work?
Oh, 100%, because when you're leading photography trips now, you're with these people who paid lots of money to be with you, so your priority should be to help them get the images. So a lot of the time I very rarely even get my camera out when I'm leading the trips because you're looking after the people. So I always kind of say my Shetland trips, for example, I always factor in a few weeks before or after just to work on my own things. Yeah, I just take my tent up there, just camp, photograph, just be at one with nature, really. It's always good
And you say
fun.
you take your tent up there, and you told us this brilliant story at the GDT about
Yeah.
also not, well, look, I'll let you tell the story right off the bat because it was an absolutely brilliant story about, when you're preparing for trips and you're making sure you don't forget anything. And it's always memory cards and batteries, that's my thing. You just don't make that stupid mistake. But yeah, tell us what happened and like the background, what you were doing there.
Sure. A good way to start, a way to make me look really professional.
Yeah, throw you under a bus right off the bat.
Yeah,
Sorry,
exactly.
Kev.
It's fine. So I had planned to spend 3 months camping on Shetlands. I was there for May, June, July. And if anyone knows how long it takes to get to Shetland, it's quite a long time. So it's like an 8-hour drive from Liverpool to Aberdeen, a 15-hour overnight ferry, multiple ferries on Shetland, and then an hour or so walk at the end. So over a day's travel, easy.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, it's a long way to get there, and you don't even leave the British Isles.
Wow.
So I was camping there, so I did all this travel. I got all the way up to Shetlands and opened the boot of my car. After all that, I opened it. And the one thing I forgot was my tent. I'd gone to camp there for 3 months and left my tent under my bed at home. It was so
Oh,
ridiculous.
man.
But the actual crazy craziness was it, as I opened my boot, there was a lady in the car park too. And she recognized me off social media through photography. So she let me sleep in her motor home. So I slept in her motorhome rather than camping while I waited my tent to arrive from home.
That's
It was so nice. So yeah, she was making me like I had a warm bed, a cooked meal every night. It was so much nicer than camping. So when my tent finally did arrive up in Shetland, I kind of kept it quiet for a few days. Enjoyed a few extra nights in this comfy motor. It was so much fun. But it kind of was still just your faith in humanity because a big gamble for this lady who is now a good friend now.
Yeah.
But at the time, I was kind of just a stranger off social media and let me stay in her motor.
That's absolutely brilliant. And like, well,
But
it's
yeah,
such a great story. I
it's
love
so
that.
good.
Yeah, I
Yeah.
love that.
So much trouble. Yeah, it's one of the moments where you open the boot of your car and think, oh yeah, where's my
Your
tent?
heart just sinks, doesn't it?
I was like, oh no, what a
Oh,
disaster. And then
God.
I left it under my bed at home. The most It's just so ridiculous.
So did you eventually leave and then camp and she was still there? And
Yeah,
yeah.
so eventually we went down to Lerwick, which is the main town in town in Shetland. I collected my tents. And then we went our separate ways. I actually did camp actually up there for
Yeah.
the rest of the trip. It wasn't never quite as comfortable as the motor home. But it's such an amazing place to actually camp on the cliffs and kind of immerse yourself in the environment is such a great way to photograph.
That is brilliant. Yeah. And can you tell us a bit about, I mean, I'm always interested in other photographers' processes, but that's a really good chunk of time, isn't it? Just to dedicate yourself to one location, like 3 weeks solid, just to photograph. Yeah. And tell us, like, what the species you were photographing, your techniques, your thought processes, storytelling, all of that kind of stuff that goes into your photography.
Like for me, like with photography, I've only really focused on like a handful of species. So like the puffins, mountain hares, like mostly UK subjects. And I do that because it means you can commit as much time as possible. So by camping on the cliffs, I was first inspired by people like Paul Nicklin and Vincent Meunier. People that like Vincent Meunier, he was camping in Dovrefell working with the muskox. And by truly immersing yourself in the habitat gives you the best possible chance to create new unique images, be on hand for the best weather, the best conditions. And I kind of think, I know every photographer works in different ways, but some people like to like photograph lots of different things. And I always find if you keep fleeting from one to the next, you may never quite do that species justice. So for me, I like to work on, so that's why I camp with the puffins on the cliffs, because you can just be with them all the time, just focusing purely on them. And then eventually you can produce such a great body of work because your core focus is being in their environment and just working with them day in, day out. It's such a, it's a great way to photograph.
It's absolutely brilliant. And then of course I guess what I think about, and I'm sure you do as well, is like you then have this a range of images and with using different lenses, and I guess you probably start to understand individual animals, or you'll start seeing the same animals and some are more brave. And is that how it works also with those bird species?
Exactly. And once you kind of like the most important bit while photography is knowing your subjects. And you can spend all your time with puffins, for example, or whatever you choose. You really get to know them well. But the only drawback of camping on the cliffs is it's quite tricky to charge your camera batteries.
So how do you do that? What's the
So to do that, there's actually the most northerly cafe in the British Isles called the Final
final
Checkout.
checkout is brilliant,
Yeah,
man.
it's this old corrugated iron cafe. It's about an hour or so hike back from where I was camping. So every day in the middle of the day, when the light was quite high and harsh, I hiked back out to charge all my batteries. And the only issue with that is you eat far too many cheese toasties. The only way to justify being in this cafe all day charging my batteries was to keep buying cheese toasties over and over
That's
again.
brilliant.
Yeah, so that's how I kept charging all my batteries, by eating cheese toasties and using electricity.
Yeah, and like burning calories doing a 2 hour hike forwards, and you
Exactly. So
needed the
yeah,
cheese
you're right.
toastie.
Exactly. So I basically, the whole time I was camping on Shetland, I lived on cheese
That is
toasties.
amazing. That is so good. And you mentioned puffins, and obviously, I guess it's a little bit like me with foxes. You're just, you're the puffin man, aren't you, really?
Exactly. Yeah, it's funny because like I haven't tried to move away from it, but whatever you try and do now, like I'll always be associated with puffins, and like even if I try and get away from that, I don't think I possibly can
No, I think
now.
you just have to give up. Like,
You just
just,
embrace it and accept who I am now.
that's you, exactly.
Like obviously, like some of the nicknames, like the Puffin Man was the first one. I was like, okay, the Puffin Man's not so bad. But when the Prince of Puffins came, I was like, this is getting a bit ridiculous now. But when I first heard it, I was like, okay, but now I actually really like the Prince of Puffins. It's pretty cool.
I think, get the t-shirt made up, can start
Exactly.
selling
Yeah,
it on your
go
store.
full brand.
That's brilliant. But one of the great things, well, there were so many great things about your talk in Germany and just following your work over the last, 10 or so years, is it just, I think what's important and an important reminder, and I say this to myself, and recently I had a meeting with an editor, and this was about my work at the cemetery, and she said to me this great thing. It was almost like a being in therapy. She looked at, a selection of 50 or so images, and her first bit of feedback was, "Oh, I think you're being hard on yourself. Like you need to go and have more fun, and remember like why you got into photography." And I thought about you after that, and I thought, actually, your presentation and some of the lovely behind the scenes stuff where you've got puffins on your back and stuff, but it just looks like you're having a lot of fun. And I think that comes through with the images.
Yeah, but it does, and it also, it's the subjects you work with too, because like whoever you show puffins to, for example, like they never fail to put a smile on your face. They're so like charismatic and got personalities, and like they just, everyone I take, every workshop I take, or people I show, they just make people smile. So like It's easy to work with subjects which make people smile because they keep, yeah, it's a way to keep a smile on your own face at the same time
Yeah,
too.
definitely, definitely. But what
Great
about,
little
like, as well as having fun, what other kind, I guess also when you become known for, specializing in one animal and the, seabird, like the puffin, what are the pitfalls? Like, are you hard on yourself? Do you always try and strive to get, better pictures? And
I think
what are the frustrations and the difficulties that you go through when you're, if you're going to do another shoot in, which I'm sure you will in 2026, what will you be looking for that's different?
100%. I think that as photographers, we always have to be our own worst critic. Like, sometimes you go too far in the end where you don't like any of your images, which is really bad, but you have to be your own worst critic. And I think for subjects like puffins, for example, which are so well photographed, you see them in your social media feeds all summer, all you see is these images of puffins. So the bar has been raised higher with these subjects than pretty much any other, really. So I'm almost putting too much pressure on myself now to try and find like new innovative ways, whether it's light or composition or creativity, to showcase these animals, because it's you can't really just get away with showing an average puffin image anymore, because they just get lost in the whole ether, really. So you have to keep, it's almost too much pressure on myself to keep trying to almost better myself year on year. So you're just putting a lot of pressure on yourself to do that.
And it's not just puffins, right? You're photographing. I know you said it's only a handful of species, but tell us a little bit about the other species that you photographed, and also particularly with Andy Parkinson. I know you guys have photographed quite a lot together over the years.
So we may touch on a bit later, but like, yeah, I've done a lot with the mountain hares with my good friend Andy, who's, yeah, he's been a bit of an unofficial mentor for me really over the years. And I'm not too sure where my photography would be without his help in the early days, to be honest.
That's really
But
nice.
he's been a great, yeah, he's such a great guy. But we worked together on the mountain hare project. We stayed at a cottage just outside the Cairngorms. Almost every single day in February, January, February, and March, we were just up on this hill working with the mountain hares in all conditions. And they're kind of interesting mountain hares because they're opposite of what you want. Normally, we're seeking like beautiful light or these nice conditions, but you want the complete opposite of mountain hares. You basically want the worst weather possible. You want like snow and wind and blizzards and all these conditions that really showcase these kind of these amazing animals. And they're just great animals to spend time with.
Yeah, and that's the point of documenting, isn't it? It would be no point if you made it look like the Bahamas every day,
No,
Yeah.
exactly. But it's like it's I know you should never kind of humanize or thingy animals, but when you work with puffins, they're more of a like a collective. You don't know the individual. But when we work with the mountain hares, every single day we're working with this small group, these three to four mountain hares. And you got to know every single one of them so well. You knew their unique behaviors, when they would do this, where they would be. And it's so great really getting to know an animal like that. It's not often that you really get like this connection where they accept you in their lives. It's so special. I remember this one hare one day where I was like almost face to face with it, and I fell asleep, and I woke up, and not sure how much later, and the mountain hare was still there, like face to face with me. Look, he's still there.
I picture
But
some like Disney scene, you
almost
like
pretty
curled
much. I
up,
was like
having a little rest.
half buried in the snow, and his hair was there face to face. But because there's this one individual like we got to know over a long period. We called it Lady, this hare, and such a special individual. And this hare has probably done more for my career, maybe Andy's career too, than any other, because we've had so much success. Like my first ever success was getting the front cover of the British Wildlife Photography Awards, and that was with an image with this hare. Andy's had images in like Wildlife Talk for the Year and whatnot with this hare, and he's done so much for our careers. He's such a special individual, this
That's so
one.
good, isn't it? And I just think I love those stories because it's just a reminder as well that there's no way around the hard work. And
No,
the
he's
hard work is putting in the time. And putting in the
exactly.
time means that the animal is comfortable with you. You're not feeding this animal, you're just there in her environment and not a threat, so much so that, you know, she'll fall asleep or you'll fall asleep and she'll still be there. But that is how you get, that's how you get those images that are just, you know, that are just on another level. And I love that. That's real field craft.
Yeah, this is what I was saying earlier. I think what I love about mountain hare photography, it feels like a true throwback to what wildlife photography kind of should be. Kind of, you need to know your subject, the field craft, the photography, being out exploring, finding the animal. You have to locate the animals on the hillside first. It's not like you're kind of being going to these honeypot locations. It's right back to the basics of wildlife photography, like hiking and finding the animal. And the only way you can get these kind of really special images is by really knowing these subjects and knowing how to approach them, how to get near them, like how to let them accept you into their lives. It's so special being kind of, yeah, working with these animals.
And did you make your own cheese toasties back at the cottage?
No, but the chip shop did these amazing veggie sausages. So I was in there every evening eating veggie sausages.
Amazing.
Yeah, they were great. And actually, and also these reduced bakery products in Tesco too. These 10p croissants on the chocolate. Every
so you've got a really like high end diet while you're out on location. Yeah. we're finding out about Kev's secret recipes.
Who cares about photography? This is all about my dietary requirements on the sheets.
That is absolutely brilliant. But I mean, also throwing on top of that, I mean, it's, I guess in some ways it's kind of dull, but actually also the health and safety side of things. I mean, if you're out on these like blizzard slopes for many, many hours, you've got to have some serious gear. Also your camera gear, like, you know, how do you keep those batteries going? How do you keep yourself warm? All of that kind of stuff, you know, and this is in Scotland, you know, this is in the middle of winter. It's like proper cold.
Yeah, people don't realize like kind of the Scottish Highlands can be as dangerous as anywhere. Like we've been up on that hill in complete whiteouts. You can only see just see your hand in front of your face.
And amazing.
If you don't know these hills, then you could easily get disorientated or lost. And then the tricky thing is keeping yourself warm too.
Yeah.
Because basically hares, they do very little. they do like very, very little. Like they are nocturnal animals. They will spend hours and hours just sitting doing nothing. And the thing, like mountain hares are perfectly adapted to those conditions, so that it doesn't bother them.
Yeah.
But for us lying next to them, it's freezing. It's like lying on the snow right next to it for hours doing nothing. So we had the kind of system in the end to keep warm where we just kind of crawled back a little bit away from the hair and started doing like press-ups or sit-ups or any way to kind of like keep your blood flowing, really.
But without spooking the hair, right?
Exactly, yeah. But you crawled back a little bit just to kind of get some space and do some press-ups.
I kind of love it. You imagine this from the hare's point of view. You've got these two guys, like, what on earth is going on here?
You can, you know, Andy, well, you can imagine seeing us across the hillside doing press-ups on this snowy hillside. The pair of us doing it in tandem.
That's amazing.
But actually, I was more of the sit-ups, actually. I haven't got the best upper body strength.
Amazing. So, look, we touched on it off-air, and I was like, look, let's save it. And I wanted to go back and talk a bit about, you know, your early stages of your career and how you got into it, because I first found out it wasn't until you were 30, right? So what were you doing right up until you picked up a camera?
Oh, you don't really want to know what I was doing the previous no, but a joke. But yeah, so as many of us, like, I've always loved wildlife since I was a kid, really. That's always been one of my biggest passions in life.
Yeah.
And like growing up in I grew up in Liverpool, and like the thoughts of like being a wildlife photographer were just, that wasn't even like a thing. Like, like no one knew, like I had no idea you could be a wildlife photographer growing up in the streets of Liverpool. Like, or you'd be like, I don't know, like a builder or a welder or a plumber or something. I didn't even know wildlife photography was even a job. Like, it was so, like, I had no idea. But then I was quite lucky, because when I was in my late 20s, I went traveling around, well, not traveling, but went on a holiday with my brother across Canada. And I had this really small, like, I don't know, point and shoot camera with me. And as we traveled across, we've seen all these, like, I've seen, like, I did actually see some bears, some moose, some deer. And I really, like, I just took some snapshots along the way doing that. And I really enjoyed the process of it. But obviously, these images were rubbish because I had absolutely no idea what I was doing, like, at that stage. But when I got back again to Liverpool, I really enjoyed the process of taking the images. So I thought, oh, actually, I went into my nearest local camera shop and picked up a small point and shoot, like basically entry-level DSLR, really. And I actually just started teaching myself photography. So I started photographing on the ducks and the geese on the pond next to my house. And I used to spend every morning and every evening just photographing these geese. And that was kind of where I, first, I really learned how to use my camera then, like, without realizing, like, I got to learn how light fell and compositions and how to use the camera, its settings, by just self-teaching myself
That's
by working
brilliant.
on.
So you didn't have any like tuition or like
Oh,
you just.
no. I just went on the pond next to my house and just started messing around with the camera when these good geese and ducks and, like, I think one of the things I can always say to so many people is the best way to learn a camera, teach yourself how to use a camera, is just experiment locally. Just get out with your camera and just photograph, like, ducks or geese or squirrels or anything that's by your house. And it truly is the best way to learn. So that was basically what I was. So why I was doing that, and then I remember seeing on the internet somewhere. It was the first edition of Bird Photographer of the Year, actually, the competition. And I at that stage, like, what, I only got a few images of geese here. I didn't, like, I thought, oh, I'm just gonna put a few in here for a bit of fun and see what happens. I didn't really know about the competition, I just seen it on the internet. And I actually two of my kind of the geese shots got highly commended in the first edition. And
Amazing.
I was like, oh wow, because these were just geese shots and mess around in the pond by my house. And I was a bit like, oh well, how has this happened, kind of thing. And then I remember then I had an opportunity. I seen, well, I don't know where it came or how I got aware of it, but just seen Skomer. It's an island in South Wales. So I thought, oh, I'll just take my camera there and visit that place. I just took a few pictures of puffins. And then, really, I don't really know what happened in the 10 years or so after that. And now I am somehow here now. It's all been a bit of like a crazy whirlwind, really. I just took a few pictures of puffins on Skomer, and the next thing it's like, yeah. And then next thing, a decade later, I had my book out. I won the overall of Bird Photographer of the Year for my work with puffins. I got my successful, like, business now, like, doing this as a career. It's just crazy. And, like, I'm so grateful, like, I can do this as a job. And every single day when I wake up, it's like, is this real,
Yeah,
kind of
is
thing.
it going to be taken away from you?
I know a lot of people go, like, there's a lot of set routes people take now, like going through Bristol University or taking these courses or whatnot. But I was just like, yeah, I just picked up a camera, soft program, some geese on my pond, and next thing I'm doing this as a job.
There you go,
But
listeners. It's easy as that. Just pick up a camera.
exactly, it's
Yeah, take
like,
pictures of geese on the pond. But I think it's true. Like we, you know, you're joking about it, but that is how you start. And I think that is really
exactly.
encouraging. And I do think the message is getting across, particularly since COVID, that, you know, you travel is obviously fun and exotic and, you know, I've done it. I know you've done it, but like, I get so excited about going out locally, like more than ever, you
A
know,
100%. Like, I'm the same as you. Like, I have and do like foreign travel, but what I'm passionate about is stuff at home locally.
yeah.
I feel like, say, for example, you go on a big trip somewhere, you'll probably have 7 to 10 days there normally when you go on these trips, and you are kind of at the mercy of what conditions you have on that trip, what images you can get. But if you're working on, say, your fox project or my geese project or puffins, and they're UK-based projects, you could dedicate as much time as you possibly want to these subjects. And the images you produce and the body you work produce will be so much stronger. And, like, as UK wildlife photographers, we should really be celebrating what we have on our doorsteps here, especially in this day and age now as well. Well, like, so much foreign travel is a bit frowned upon, the world's changing. We should just Just focus on stuff close to home, really.
Yeah, I mean, you're preaching to the converted. I
you're
couldn't
on
agree
to
more. Yeah, exactly.
hopefully a few of the listeners can understand.
Definitely. Well, look, you mentioned very briefly your book there, and I can see it nicely placed over your shoulder. But yeah, tell us a bit about that process and journey, and when you had the idea to do it, and you know, just the whole process, because you know, I've made a few books and they're a wonderful thing to have, but they're a bloody slog as well.
Yeah,
just getting the
yeah,
things
so
funded
well, yeah,
and
they're...
yeah, everything. It's such hard work.
Oh, to be honest, when I undertook it, it was my first book, so I didn't really realize how big an undertaking it was, and it was huge. The one positive, I wrote my book during the COVID years, so in those kind of crazy years, it really gave me something to focus on and concentrate on, which kind of kept my mind busy because I had this to work on. But it's, as you say, it's such a big undertaking, and I actually got approached by a publisher after winning Bird Photographer of the Year.
Ah, okay.
So that was kind of what kickstarted this. So a publisher approached me then and asked if I would be interested in producing a book. I never really thought about producing a book because, yeah, but I never just considered it. But when they got in touch, it'd be such an amazing thing to do. And I don't feel like for me it was ever like a financial reason to do it. I think it's like a legacy thing. To say you have produced a book is such a great, like a milestone in your photography career, really, and a way to celebrate almost a decade's work with Puffins.
Yeah.
To have in a book, and every time I go into, say, like Bempton Cliffs or Waterstones, and I see it kind of on the shelf now, I'm still like, oh my, wow,
Yeah,
it's so crazy. I still can't help it. I still quite can't quite believe that it's on a shelf. It's great. It blows my
you're
mind.
presenting a case that you're like an accidental photographer.
I know. Yeah, maybe I should. No, but this, like, when I talk about, like, it's kind of, it still blows my mind, but it was a hell of a lot of work, because not just the book itself, like a decade's worth of images for the book as well.
Yeah.
Kind of like,
And tell us about that process, because you know I self-publish, and I've had a publishing self you know my independent publishing company since 2009. So I know how it works when you do it, you know, fully by yourself, not with an external publisher. So how was that relationship and editing and deciding what went on the front cover and the flow and the chapters? What was that process like?
it was really great. So I went through a publisher, and they give me quite a lot of control on the book, which is really helpful. So
That's great.
I had the editor, who I kind of wrote my I did all the text myself for the book. So I basically wrote each chapter, sent it to him, he checked it and sent it back. It took quite a bit of time in the first few steps, because when he kind of rewrote my work, he was not writing it in my voice, bringing it back in almost like this Shakespearean voice almost. I was a bit like, oh God, that's definitely not my voice. So it took us a bit of going back and forth, so we got the middle ground, really, where we were both happy with how the text looked. And even the graphic that the employed a graphic designer, which I worked with too, and he gave me full control too and how I want to design the book, which is really
That's
nice.
amazing.
The one bit was I overruled them with the front cover image they wanted, because they wanted this image of a puffin in the rain, which was a nice image, but I really wanted like a big bold statement image on the front, which is the oh, oh people forgot people can't see the screen
I
I'm
tell
putting my hand.
we'll definitely put links up so people will be able to see. We'll
Never.
put it on your page on my site. We'll put the link to the book for sure.
Yeah, so it's just that I want a big bold cover image, really. But it was a lot of time writing the text. So that was the big bulk of it, really. And I went back and forth so many times, because I never wanted it just to be a pretty puffin picture book, really, because
Yeah.
that'd be pointless. Like, nobody would gain anything from that. So what I wanted to do was tell their story, tell the issues they face now, and how what we can do to help them. And also weave in some of my ridiculous stories in the middle of it too. But the main core of it was to actually showcase the threats they face and what we can do to help them, because that's free photography, that's one of the most important things we can do, really, because we're lucky enough to see some of these things, like spend months with puffins or with mountain hares or all these subjects. And it's great to bring their stories into the homes of people who aren't quite as lucky as us. And it's, yeah, that's one of the key reasons why I do photography, really.
And that's brilliant. I think it's, you know, there's so much thirst and need for that kind of storytelling. Whereas, I don't know about you, but I grew up on long lens wildlife photography that was about, not really about conservation. There was some conservation messaging, but it was much more about, you know, look at this animal in beautiful wilderness, you know, like a polar bear or, you know, whatever it is, wolves, you know, exotic and charismatic creatures. But like, I kind of feel like those days are sort of gone. I mean, not completely. There's obviously always a place for a beautiful behavior picture, but I think certainly in wildlife photography, the way it's going, it's about telling stories, like you say, bringing them to people. And is that something that has changed for you over, you know, the last 10 years of you doing this? Are you now much more focused on storytelling with your images?
Yeah, I think there is still room for these beautiful, like, beautiful images, I think, of the subjects, because it's these beautiful images which help people kind of connect with them and kind of almost fall in love with them and become passionate about them too. But I also agree, you're right though, that there has been a big shift in my own photography from that, which is how I used to shoot. And now I prefer to shoot much wider these days and tell more of their story. So I like to incorporate the habitat and the environment. So not just like a pretty close-up of a puffin. I like to showcase the environment in, tell their stories. And not something that I want to focus on more on in the future is also showing the human relationship with the animals too. Like, how the researchers work with what are their conservation efforts, how the scientists work with these subjects, what are their conservation efforts. And I think, oh yeah, that is one thing lacking for my work. I think to tell the full story, I think that will be a really crucial element to add more to my work going forwards.
It's funny, isn't it? Yeah, I think that kind of style of photography is why, it's why kind of one of the reasons why I got into wildlife photography, because I didn't want to take any pictures of people,
No.
and now you're kind
No.
of, it's cut, you know, and not that you can obviously photograph what you want, and again, it's no slight on any photographer that doesn't want to go down that route, because I totally agree. There's, we talk about it a lot on this podcast, is conservation storytelling, but there's, you know, sometimes we just don't want to hear, you know, depressing news, or we just want to see a beautiful image of a puffin or a penguin in a sunset, because you're right, it just makes us feel good, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. And yeah, dipping your toe into that conservation storytelling, it's like a whole other skill set that you need, and, you know, learning and lens choice, and then being able to talk to people in a way that they're comfortable with you, and almost spending the time with the people, the similar amount of time with the people that you do with the puffins or whatever subject it is that you're going to photograph, so that then they're relaxed about you, so you can capture those nice moments. And it's not easy, you know, certainly since I've been doing it in the last few years, you know, focusing more on people in the landscape and telling their story. Funnily enough, it has become more like wildlife photography and trying to capture those moments. Because generally, I'm sure you have this as well with puffins, like most of the time they're not doing spectacular stuff. They don't have, not every puffin comes back with 10 sand
No.
eels in its beak, right?
No. Yeah,
And I think that's the same with people. Like, you know, how
yeah.
do you make that conservation photograph of scientists or researchers, you know, tell that complete story in a really succinct way?
But it's like, it doesn't always have to be this kind of conservation storytelling, really. Because, for example, the talk I did at the GDT the other week, 99% of the talks were about climate change or wildlife trafficking or all these kind of, or yeah, the melting ice caps. These really hard hitting issues, and which we need to be talked about. But then it came to my talk, and what I did in my talk was basically just show beautiful images of puffins and helped and put a smile on people's faces. You can connect with people in that way. Like, I mean, I don't get me wrong, we all need to know about climate change, these big issues, but they're always like so kind of like in your face. Sometimes you just need a second to for people to put a smile on their face and to connect. Like, the amount of people have kind of messaged me over the years and said, like, they fell in love with puffins because of my
That's
photography. And
brilliant.
I've never shown like hard hitting puffin images, just beautiful images of these birds. And by people kind of like falling in love with them, become passionate by that way, that's also a way for them people to kind of then research them or help protect them or conserve them. Not by showing hard hitting images, by just sharing beautiful images for people to, yeah, to get passionate about the subject.
Yeah,
And I think that's like
definitely.
a different way as well. They both
They
work
do,
really.
yeah, exactly. And one shouldn't be like considered, higher than the other. And I think exactly what you say, if you can, if your images inspire people to fall in love with a subject, then they will might want to go and learn more about it. And then if they love it, then there's a greater chance that they'll want to protect it. That I hear that phrase all the time now, and it's so true. So thank you for all the amazing work you do on puffins.
It's not a problem. I'll
But
keep going.
when I was, I mean, you've got so much great stuff on your site, and again, we'll put that in the links. And just going through your portfolio, and I was curious about the images you've got of goats, because I noticed something. I think you said you were going to be doing more of in
Yeah, yes.
2026. Is that right?
Yep,
Yeah.
100%.
So kind of talk a little bit about that subject, and you've had success with some of these images, and some of them are really beautiful, like these goats in the oddest positions. So like, tell us about your photography with them, but also about like what they're doing. Are they wild, what species they are? I mean, yeah, I don't know anything about it, so yeah, educate me.
I'll educate you on goats. So these are no particular kind of rare or unique species of goats, but it's the habitat which makes this place so special. So they kind of live in a place called the Norwich Slate Mine in North Wales. It's absolutely amazing place. The sheer scale, it used to be the biggest slate mine in the whole of the UK at one point until it got closed down. But it's completely closed down now, but it still remains all the old buildings, like the old engine room, the sawmill, and these like really unique buildings. And then like the goats just roam around the whole landscape. And the images you can get there are so unique, like this tiny goat, this massive slate landscape, or inside the building with the old engine room, and still got the date dated right back. It's such an amazingly unique place. But yeah, you do need to be quite fit to get there because these goats cover a lot of ground up and down. So to get all the way up and down, trying to follow the goat is not very easy. But
What are the cafes nearby to keep you fueled there?
yeah, I've sampled them. There's a nice cafe that does some good omelets nearby.
Omelets, chips, and cheese toasties. I mean, this is
Yeah,
incredible.
that's it. Always chips and omelets at the end of a goat day. It's always a tradition. Yeah. But it's funny because you think these goats are really hardcore animals. But whenever we go, we always want it to be a wet day. Because whenever it's raining, the goats take shelter in these old buildings. When they go into the buildings is when you get these really unique shots of them on the machinery or, yeah, all this like old stuff that's been left behind from when it closed down. And you get shots of them standing in the windows, which is quite cool. But you wait, as soon as it rains, you'll run inside to these buildings and take shelter.
I mean, that is so much fun and so unique as a project. And when you say when we go, is that do you run tours there to
No.
no,
So I think,
this
yeah,
is a personal project.
it's a personal project. I've got one of my good friends, a guy called Stuart Hill, and we go together from time to time. It's a place. I don't want to do workshops there. I don't do trips there.
Yeah.
In this day and age, you just need something still to yourself at
Yeah, and
times.
that's what I was going to ask you about, passion projects. I mean, obviously you're passionate about everything that you shoot, but like there's that mixture of also you have to make a living. Tours are a really good way of doing that, and you're doing well out of that. But yeah, how do you make and find time for passion projects such as the goats or any other stuff that you've got going on? And it's because that's the thing, it's the hard to try and find those blocks of time when actually you've got to earn money, but you also need to build up, you need to do stuff that you love and want to showcase as well.
One thing that's quite helpful for me is I kind of have a really intense period from, say, April to the end of July. And they're quite, it's actually quite helpful that the seabed's on here all year round.
Yeah, you'd be knackered.
You kind of like have this super intense 4 months or so, and then give yourself a little bit of downtime on either side of that, which is normally a time when I kind of work on a lot of my own projects.
Right.
So like March time, April time, or the other end, like September, October time,
Nice.
a lot of time working on personal projects. And I have a really big aspiration for 2026, which is something I've been working on for a few years now, but not really too active in posting about it.
Well, the listeners are going to get this hot off the press on,
Yeah, this is the first time off the
big
press, actually.
announcement. It's a
Yeah, I'm
scoop.
not sure where. Yeah. I'm not sure this might actually be a bit of a letdown when I announce it, but I'll say it anyway. So, 2026 is the Chinese Year of the Horse.
Ah.
And I've always been passionate about our native ponies, the British Isles. So in 2026, my year-long project is to celebrate the native ponies at the British Isles. And that means stuff like the Shetland pony, the Highland pony, the Eriskay, the Dales, the Fell, the Dartmoor, the Exmoor, all these native pony breeds.
Wow.
And there's never really been a true body of work to showcase these ponies, which effectively shaped our landscape. And people just don't even, not even that aware of them, actually. And I think it'd be a fascinating project to showcase them, how they were originally historically used for. Like stuff like the Highlands, like, or the Eriskays carrying seaweed, or the Shetlands and that kind. I think it'd be a great project. I don't think it's really been done properly in depth before.
Yeah.
And it's the hard thing in this photography world now. Like everything has been photographed, really, like to some extent.
Sure.
So trying to find a new project, a new body of work, is not quite as easy these
Yeah.
days.
Or if it has been done, then you just do it even better than the last person,
Yeah,
you know.
exactly. Yeah,
I mean, that's,
exactly.
when I interviewed
Yeah.
Jasper Duus, way back in 2018, one of my questions to him, because he did all this lovely work with the macaques, in Japan, in the hot pools, was like,
Yeah.
that's a long way to go for a Dutch photographer. Like,
Yeah.
and of course they're so well photographed. And then, he expanded that story into the human side and the conflict with farmers and the macaques. But he also got some beautiful images of those monkeys in those hot pools that like were very unique and not kind of been seen before. So even if someone has done ponies, Kev,
That's true. Yeah, there's always,
it's just,
I think it'd be an interesting project to work on. I think there's a lot to it, and ultimately I want to eventually go the same way as the puffins and produce a book in the
yeah, I could
end.
really see that as a book. And it's
Yeah,
countrywide as well, like different parts of the
exactly. I think
country.
I would tell the stories of the people who work with the ponies too, rather than puffins, which was my own story. I'd like to tell the stories of the ponies from the people that work with them. I think that'd be, yeah, I think it'd be a really great story to
Oh, I can't
tell.
wait. Can't wait to see it.
Yeah,
The only
yeah.
problem now is that 1 million people who listen to this podcast now, I'm just
Yeah,
joking.
yeah.
They're going to be
Now
expecting
everyone will be, yeah,
it.
or everyone will be doing it now.
Yeah, it's true. Oh, what a brilliant idea for my New Year project. No, I mean, that's great. I could completely picture that as a really, really nice book with, different landscapes, different characters. I can imagine some of the people that work with these horses are
Oh,
real
yeah, I think
characters.
it'd be really good. And again, it's another celebration of British wildlife. Well, even though it's not truly, truly wild, because we don't have any truly wild native ponies left in Britain anymore. They're all semi-wild to
Yeah.
some extent. But still, I think it'd be a fantastic. And this is what you said, like, about it would purely be a personal project to me.
Yeah.
There are no future plans of workshops or trips or just something which we all need, really, in this day and age, just because it's easy to become a wildlife photographer, a professional wildlife photographer, and forget why you fell in love with it in the first place. Because you spend 9 months of the year leading trips or workshops, and you want to strip it back and just photograph, which is why you love doing it in the first place.
Yeah, I think that's so true, and keeping an eye on that is important, because it's, that the idea when you're younger, like you're saying, oh, I can't believe I'm doing this, and what a privilege every morning I wake up and doing it. But obviously you've totally earned it. But at the same time, then you have to keep an eye on, oh, actually, am I giving myself enough time? And we're all guilty of, I'm just repeating what you're saying, but we're all guilty of like never finding enough time to go and do our work. And I think, particularly since I had this meeting with an editor, for me personally, is actually when I've, you know, I've been back to the cemetery a couple of times since then, and I'm looking at it differently. I'm thinking, yeah, okay, a cemetery is kind of a serious place. And, yeah, you know, there's, you have to be respectful and there are people mourning grave owners or whatever. But like, this place is also full of life and it's full of fun things to go and see. And that's why people also go there, because it's impressive and magical and all of these other adjectives I could think of. They're like, well, why not capture that? You know, it doesn't have to be this sort of sad British, solemn, you know, respectful, you know, there's like loads going on there. And I think that, yeah, just reminding ourselves, I mean, this has been quite a good chat actually, you know, and hopefully the listeners will get something out of that, but actually it's just got to go and have fun.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a big thing. Like admit, like, I know I always constantly am having fun, but doing this as a full-time career, there's a lot of pressure on you. It's not always fun and like happy. Like it can be quite isolated or quite lonely or quite difficult doing this on your own. Like it can be tricky. Like it's like these kind of like, so you just need to enjoy the moments you do have, like the moments make you smile, the moments to have fun, because it's not easy doing this for yourself.
Yeah, it's so often the case, isn't it? You think, oh, I want to be a professional, and you get there and you're like, oh, I wish I had time for my photography or time to do other things. And it's like, and the grass is always greener.
Exactly. That's half the issue. Like when I first started, like I had not a care in the world. Like I was just photographing purely for me, just doing these like, I don't know, Mowen hairs and puffins and gannets and all, just going out just to take images.
Yeah.
As you get deeper and deeper and deeper into doing this as a career, it's like, oh, you can't, it's so easy to lose that.
Definitely.
Why, like, bit of love or forget why you did it in the first place.
Yeah.
It's so easy. It's
definitely. So, Kev, God, it's been going nearly 50 minutes. Unbelievable.
Oh, wow.
So, look, we there's a few more things I want to ask you, and, you know, before I let you go. And, you know, we talked a little bit about, you know, getting recognition and in the social media age. And obviously, you've been successful in competitions and stuff like that. So, you know, what kind of, you know, you've mentioned some bits and pieces of advice throughout this podcast, but, you know, younger people listening to this who think, oh God, you know, Kev, I want to be in his shoes, you know, and I think it is much more difficult these days, because like we say, everyone's a wildlife photographer.
Yeah.
You know, social media just, you know, is a test to that. And, you know, you do see young people with like really, really great photographs. But yeah, what would be your advice to a younger person wanting to get into this industry and making a living from it?
I agree. It's like it's harder for young people now to break in, because there's so many people with cameras now that it's just become more competitive than it ever was. But I think ultimately what you need to do is carve out some kind of niche for yourself. Like, for example, like what me and Matt have done, really. Like, I got known for puffins, Matt got known for foxes. Like, find like a niche for yourself, like, focus on that, like, get known for that. Like, I think if you're almost too generalist these days, it's quite tricky, because you won't get known for individual thing. You can get kind of like connotated or associated with one subject and got known for that. Like, it makes such a big difference to your career. Like, if I'd never like picked up a camera and started photographing puffins, I generally don't think I would be where I am today. So I would kind of like, but the key thing is, though, it has to be something you're passionate about. Because if you're not passionate about it and you're just doing it for the sake of it, it just won't work. Because like, you have to be like dedicated, like, I don't know, spend every day, spend weeks on this subject. Like, don't, you can't dip in and out, because you really need to do it for the love of it. Because if you're not passionate about it, like, it'll really show through in your images. You have to love it. And if you love what you're doing, it will show through in your images. Yeah. And I think a lot of people get bogged down by the whole social media world. Like, oh, this isn't getting like many likes, this isn't getting any likes. Like, I honestly wouldn't worry about it. Like, it's so kind of like, oh, it's like, it doesn't matter. Like, social media, they're not true reflections on how good an image actually is. Like, looking when, like, GDT, when I was there recently, some of these massive names got such small followings, but it doesn't matter. Like, they are producing amazing imagery. Just because you have, say, 100,000 followers doesn't make you a better photographer.
Sure, sure.
So just kind of, like, don't take it too personally, and just shoot what you love and the rest will fall in place,
yeah,
really.
It's a bit of a necessary evil, isn't it, social media?
It really is. Yeah, like it really is. It's not something like people get too hung up on it at times. And it's a great marketing tool, but you just can't get too hung
No,
up on
and also
it,
then
really.
you know it's nice that you get those occasional positive stories that the woman that put you up in the motorhome saw you on social media.
That's
Like they
right,
were,
that
you
is.
know, a good positive social media story.
Exactly. That's great. But I say to people, just, I mean, it's so tricky these days, but it can be done. Like you can, as long as you're passionate and that dedication, you could definitely get to, make a name for yourself in this industry.
I think that's brilliant. Positive advice. Like, very you, mate. Thank you.
Thanks.
I was also going to ask you about video work. Have you turned your hand to that at all?
No, so this is something I think going forwards, I may need to introduce more into my work, because I do a lot of work with Canon, for example, and they every time I do a talk now, they are trying to push more and more to be more to the video side than the still side. But it's such a tricky one though, because at heart, I am a still photographer, and that is what I love to do. So I feel like the industry is shifting towards that direction. But maybe I'm still a bit of a dinosaur and don't want to follow that shift, like, and still keep doing what I'm doing, which is shooting stills. And shooting stills will always be like what I'm passionate about. And I may dabble into a bit of video in the time, but no, stills
Yeah, it's
will
almost
always
like
be
you
the main
take your own
discipline.
vice, you know, back at you, which is if you're not passionate about it, then you know it's going to
Exactly,
show
exactly.
through.
Exactly, and it's just not going to show through. But say we both come through an era where all stills is what we've known, really.
Exactly.
That's what we've always got right through from you say film to today. And then to make that shift to video, it just feels, I don't know, like, yeah, I'm still based photographer, like wildlife photographer of the year. That's a pinnacle. Like still images, it's like kind of that's yeah, it's more purist, really.
I totally agree. I mean, obviously, I've done a lot in the last 6, 7 years filming, and I love it, and I do love doing both. But similarly, you know, I'm a photographer that grew up on stills, and that is my passion, and that's, yeah, where I feel that I can really immerse myself. And but also at the same time, it's different, isn't it? You know, you've got stills photographers who just like stick at that. You've got some that do both. You've just got like cinema photographers. I can imagine like there's a lot of like wildlife cinematographers out there that are pure wildlife cinematographers, and
Oh yeah,
now they've got
exactly.
all these like still photographers that reckon themselves as wildlife
Yeah.
filmmakers
Who are these people doing?
taking over their industry with their little mirrorless cameras.
It feels that
Oh
way.
mate, it's brilliant. I mean, you've talked a bit about 2026 and you know, the ponies project. Are you going to continue with the goat work? Because you've recently moved back to North Wales, right? So are you far from this location where you shoot them, where you're living now?
Oh no, it's really near now. It's about an hour or so away, which is great. So, yeah, that's perfect. So yeah, it's actually even closer now. So that's perfect.
And is that
I will be there most of the winter, really, there, because you don't want to be at the slate mine in the summer, because the light's just too harsh. You want the atmosphere in the winter, like the mist, the fog, the dark. It kind of really adds to the foreboding feeling of the slate mine, which the sun just doesn't quite lend itself too well to. I'll be there in the winter months,
Oh,
really, and
brilliant. Yeah,
it's a great project to take along during the
I can't wait
winter.
to see more from there. And again, yeah,
Oh
we'll
yeah,
put
I've been
links
there.
up. There's so many cool images and very different.
I was there a few weeks back. It was great. The only issue, the rain was so bad, my phone died. I got too much moisture in my phone. That wasn't great.
Oh my God. You know, do you go a bit further than a year ahead? Do you think like where, you know, think about where you'd like to be in 5, you know, 10 years from now? What are your hopes, wishes, and dreams?
Hopefully, it'll probably still be photographing puppies. No, it's true. These are a few things I'd love to do in the future and whatnot. You've got to think long term, really. Like for me, I know we talked a lot about UK stuff. My ultimate dream had always been to go to South Georgia, which I would love to do one day, just because it's a lot of history attached with Shackleton too. And the huge King Penguin colony there, like 500,000. So I'm going there in 2028, which is something
Ah, brilliant.
which has been a lifelong ambition. So just to go there would be amazing. But still, I think I will just keep telling the stories of stuff locally, though. Keep working on new projects with different seabirds or British wildlife. And that's my kind of passion, really.
That's brilliant, mate. And yeah, you're a real inspiration for me, and I'm sure so many. I know Andy, like you talked highly of him. He's always talked so highly of you.
Oh,
And
yeah. I sort of mentioned Andy briefly at the end, but he's been such a great guy for my career. Like, I owe Andy a lot for it.
yeah.
Like, we first met, almost when I first picked up a camera 10 years or so ago is where we first met.
That's
And
absolutely brilliant.
he's been so great, like, to have somebody like he never kind of give me specific photography like settings of advice, but just in when you first pick up a camera, being allowed able to shoot alongside someone as good as Andy, it's just been such a big help
That's
for me.
brilliant. And actually, it just reminded me of another story that you told with were you photographing gannets with Andy? And there was a story about you like putting a stake in the ground and tying a
Oh yeah, that was pretty crazy actually. We were kind of putting stakes and then ropes and hanging off the cliffs and that was pretty interesting. Yeah, that was for sure. So yeah, you gotta trust the person you're with to be doing that. So
Yeah, exactly. Because you could see it's like, oh, there's competition here. It's like, oh, well,
exactly. Yeah, oh,
next
they
thing
look
you
at
know,
me,
you're off the edge of
which
a
is where I
cliff.
drop him off the edge. But it's just, I don't really know where I'd kind of be in my career without. I mean, I may have found my own path, but he was still such a big help in the early days. Well, I owe him pretty much everything, really, to my to yeah
Oh, that's brilliant, mate.
to
Well, I'm sure
yeah.
he'll be beaming. We'll definitely end the Andy love in here because otherwise he'll
Yeah,
just.
yeah, don't, yeah. Don't
Yeah,
want to give him too much love. Like,
exactly.
not that good a guy, actually.
Oh,
Need to put him down a peg.
brilliant. Well, look, thanks so much. I'm sure the audience are going to love this. We'll release it on Boxing Day when everyone's hopefully lounging around with nothing better to do. And yeah, hear all your great stories, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what's going to happen in 2026. And yeah, just thanks so much again for coming on, Kev. It's been a real
Oh,
pleasure.
no worries. I loved it. It was great to properly chat.
All right, take care, mate.
You too, Matt. Cheers, mate. Thanks a lot. Bye.
That was so much fun. Big thanks to Kev for sharing so much with us, and what an affable and just downright lovely guy. And I really feel like that shines through with his photography. So go and check him out. His website is kevinmorgans.com. His Instagram is at kevmorgans. Or visit his page on the podcast section of my site. See the links and share this with your community and loved ones, colleagues, and family. I would like to say a special thanks to all the Patreon supporters for your support and everyone who has emailed in over the past year. With all the kind comments, it really helps with that warm, fuzzy feeling I get when putting these out there. And yeah, a reminder, New Year's Day, 6:30 p.m., BBC One for all the UK listeners. Listeners in America, this show will be coming out on PBS. I don't know exactly when. Listeners in Japan, again, I don't know the broadcaster, but it will be showed in Japan as well. Cannot wait to see it. Happy New Year, everyone. Wishing you all the best for 2026. Stay tuned. I'll see you soon.